This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is this week's Stories You Don't Want to Miss. For the week of October 30th, here are a few top stories. In the news, this week we presented the New Neighbor series. Here's one of the stories.
In our New Neighbor series, we looked at one of the areas of the Valley that has changed the most in the last 5 years, downtown Phoenix. There, in an area that doesn't even cover 2 square miles, there are nearly 5,000 housing units under construction or being planned. And there's a big debate going on about who's going to live in them. Will there be enough affordable or workforce housing to keep downtown diverse? Today, we're going to take a look at some of the surrounding neighborhoods where the downtown effect is pushing housing prices up. And for more on that, I'm joined by KJZZ's Carrie Young.
Hey, Lauren. Well, housing prices across the country have gone up a lot since 2011. Property values have increased by 83% in Maricopa County alone. And at first glance, that all sounds like good news. But those rising prices can often spell changes in a community. So we wanted to know, who's moving in, who's getting pushed out, and are we experiencing that controversial phenomenon, gentrification? My journey today begins in the Coronado neighborhood in downtown Phoenix. I'm going on a scavenger hunt of sorts with Kristen Koptiuk.
You're just looking at a neighborhood that has been improving the housing.
Koptiuk lives here in Coronado, but she's also a cultural anthropologist with Arizona State University. And in her well-air-conditioned car, we went looking for some of the physical evidence that illustrates just how much the neighborhood has changed over the last 10 years.
Anywhere there's like houses like this with that new kind of block cement walkway, and you can see that they've been very careful with the colors.
Okay, so modern upgrades to these historic houses is an obvious one. So are for sale signs and dumpsters.
Right now, it means that the owners have sold it to a flipper.
But then...
okay, here's one thing that is scary.
There are more subtle additions that, according to Koptiuk, demonstrate that the neighborhood has been significantly gentrified.
Bikes.
But not just any bikes, those brightly colored bike share bikes.
The people that live in the neighborhood do not ride these bikes. Either they have their own bike, or they would rather have public transportation improved.
Koptiuk has lived in the Coronado area since the early 90s. She says in that time, she's seen the area change from a mostly Latino and lower middle class neighborhood with homes that were often around 800 square feet to an area that's mostly upper middle class and filled with renovated homes that have massive additions tacked onto the back. Since 2011, home values have gone up by almost 120% here. Rents have also spiked about 30% in that time, too. If you travel a little farther south, you'll find Dana Johnson in the Garfield neighborhood.
If you had looked at this 20 years ago, it looks pretty bad.
Price points in this neighborhood, which is just east of 7th Street in the heart of downtown, are lower than Coronado, but they too are in the upswing. I joined him for a walk down one of the main drags in the area, and you don't have to go far to see just how much things are changing.
Across the street right here is some apartment complexes, and if you had seen those 20 years ago, you wouldn't have wanted to live in there. Here we have another reconstruct.
Even just 10 years ago, Garfield was dotted with empty lots and homes in need of repair. But it's more than just the physical structures that are different.
It was riddled with a number of gangs that were pretty violent gangs. It used to be that we would have dozens of murders a year here in Garfield.
Johnson says the neighborhood seems a lot safer these days, and there are a lot more amenities down here now, like bike lanes and walkable restaurants, but...
there's no doubt that some populations have been pushed out.
Since 2011, median household income in most areas of Garfield have increased between 20 and 30%. The question about whether the neighborhood is being gentrified is a common conversation among neighbors here. And for some, it can be a loaded term because the issue is really nuanced.
In the 1980s, we had no choice but to either improve this area or let it go to pot and raise the whole damn thing and build whatever.
So is it higher housing costs that are pushing families out of the neighborhood here? Eve Reyes-Aguirre, a 20-year Garfield resident, argues yes, but explains there are a few other factors at play.
I think the passage of SB 1070, because a lot of families in this area were undocumented and they were afraid you know, to stay living here in Arizona.
She says some Latino families have since moved back. But she adds, today, the makeup of the neighborhood is a mix of old and new, which at times can clash.
One of the neighbors that moved in was walking across the street, and they have dogs out there. And the dogs came and started barking, which is, you know, kind of what they're supposed to do.
Aguirre says the new neighbors, who weren't used to seeing pit bulls around, called animal control right away, which scared the original homeowners, who were undocumented.
I really feel like people focus on the pros and don't really see the cons to it.
Over the last 6 years, home values in Garfield have increased between 140 and 160%. And according to the online real estate database company Zillow, rents in the area are also up by more than 20% since the recession. Aguirre says while it is nice getting all of this new attention from the city and developers,
it's disheartening because I feel like, well, why didn't we get that when it was a different community?
And while Aguirre says the higher costs aren't forcing her out, her adult daughter, who wanted to live in the neighborhood after college, now can't afford to stay unless she has several roommates. If you drive even farther south and a little bit to the east, you'll find the Broadway Heritage neighborhood. This area is in a much different stage of development. Just like Garfield and the Coronado neighborhood, you'll also find building crews. But here, the purpose is not to upgrade the homes. Shelley Smith, the president of the Broadway Heritage Neighborhood Association, explains it's to fill one of the neighborhood's roughly 100 vacant lots.
A lot of the properties were left because the elders were dying off and the young people didn't want to take care of them. We had some properties taken by the city due to not cleaning the properties, drug raids.
The city started this massive infill project just before the recession. Officials picked the project back up again last year after an extended pause when the housing market crashed. Today, the city is contracting with an affordable housing developer and offering some home buyer assistance, a factor that Smith says is important because while they want to see improvement in the neighborhood, they also want to keep the existing makeup in their neighborhood, too.
Our community here, just this little neighborhood, is so diverse, from having the Latino community or Hispanic community, the African-American community. We also have Southeast Asian Indian.
Smith and the rest of the association say they're embracing all of the economic progress coming to the area because they say for years the community did without many of the city amenities that most of us take for granted, like paved sidewalks.
It was like the developer paved and curbed half of the street and the rest of it was dirt. We've pushed to get 32nd Street developed, pushing to have Rozier from 32nd Street to 36th Street.
Smith says he understands that community growth and improvement also means higher prices. Just like Coronado and Garfield, rents are also up by about 20% since 2011. But the difference in this South Phoenix community is that the household incomes have stayed about the same.
I like to tell every neighbor here that you're part of this process.
Neighborhood association members in this community say they know it can be a slippery slope to inaccessibility. That's why their plan is to take an active role in the decision-making process from the beginning, in hopes that the changes they help to make will end up benefiting the current community members for years to come. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
You can find much more on the series at neighbors.kjzz.org. This is KJZZ's Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. And now here's a story from KJZZ's original production, The Show. Here's host Steve Goldstein.
State Representative Michelle Ugenti-Rita recently went public with a Facebook post describing harassment, including, quote, unwanted sexual advances she has faced since taking office in 2011. She said she complained to House leadership at the time, but nothing meaningful was done. Ugenti-Rita told KJZZ this week that problems should have been addressed.
It shouldn't have had to come to this to have a policy like that down there. I know we're unique. We have a unique makeup. But that doesn't negate the fact that we should have very clear, precise policies in place to deal with this stuff.
House Speaker J.D. Mesnard this week unveiled a detailed policy that's intended to cut off sexual harassment. He says a policy has been in place, but perhaps wasn't clear. Again, Michelle Ugenti-Rita.
Nobody ever sat me down and said, here's our policy. Here's the steps. Here's what needs to be initiated. Could you please fill out this form? None of that existed.
Ugenti Rita also made it clear she believes any policy should cover both the House and Senate. Earlier, I spoke with Speaker Mesnard to get a deeper perspective on harassment at the Capitol and what needs to be done about it. I began by asking him why it's significant to clarify policies now.
The importance in putting this policy out there is first and foremost so that people know where to go if they're combating or addressing or feeling like they're being attacked in a sexual harassment sort of way or any sort of way. We have had policies in place, but I do think it's fair to say they haven't been clear. We have a training program that all new members and all new staff go through, but you know, you only go through it once, years might go by, sometimes you start to forget. And also when you're new, there's a lot coming at you. So we're actually going to do an ethics training refresher here at the start of the session. But in the meantime, we wanted to put it out there, put this policy out there so that people know what the process is and where to go if they're facing sexual harassment.
Now, you have been down at the Capitol for a long time, not just as a representative or as a speaker, but in many other aspects. You've been there for a pretty good portion of your life. Have you seen examples that kind of made you uncomfortable?
I haven't had anything come at me that made me uncomfortable. Sometimes you see others interacting, and you know, it's sometimes the clear line that's crossed. Sometimes it's gray. You kind of look at the person who's the recipient of certain commentary and wonder, well, do they think it's funny? Was this appropriate? I think at the end of the day, it's really important for those who feel like they're on the receiving end of inappropriate commentary or harassment to come forward. I hope they feel emboldened to come forward, because we can really only begin tackling specific situations when folks come forward and share their situations with us.
And as Speaker, you have so many responsibilities. Where does this sort of thing fall under your responsibilities from your point of view?
So it's a tricky thing. Being in the legislature as the Speaker, I have authority over everybody in the building who's an employee. I can hire and fire. So anybody who violates our anti-harassment policies, I can easily deal with if they're on staff. With legislators, it's a little trickier because I'm not their boss. They have certainly given me authority and a level of power, I suppose, but it stops short of single-handedly firing them. Only the voters can do that. There is the ability for the whole legislature to expel somebody, and usually that follows an ethics investigation and finding. But it is a little bit of a different animal than the typical workplace.
Representative Ugenti Rita was very public in saying that she brought something up more than 5 years ago, that she had an experience like that. Even since she made this public announcement, have you heard from anybody else? And I don't even mean people who have experienced this at the Capitol or whatnot, but people who are just more concerned about it. Has that been something that you've been hearing about more than you would have before she came out?
So periodically I'd have a member or a lobbyist even or someone come to me and share with me about a situation. And then a lot of what happens is the follow-up is, you know, what level of interaction or reaction do you want from me? I'm certainly willing to engage in the situation. A lot of times folks actually just want me to be aware, just want me to know, and may not want me to respond because of fear of the relationship, or they feel they address it themselves or whatnot. So it can be a little challenging to address situations, which is why individual situations, which is why we put this policy out there that's an across-the-board policy. I have had to deal with certain situations from time to time. I don't know if I'd say it's prevalent. That's probably a matter of perspective. I have members who've come out since Mrs. Ugenti Rita raised these issues and said, I think this is a problem, or no, I don't think it's a problem. Either way, we wanted to make sure that there's a policy to address it when it's a problem, and that policy is very clear.
Is there an atmosphere there that generally is comfortable, you think?
I think without question that the democratic process can be messy and uncomfortable. People often don't like to talk about politics, and yet the legislature is inherently a political institution where a variety of ideas clash with each other and different worldviews and value systems come into conflict. So it can be a very tense environment. And that's why we want to make sure that in the midst of it, our dialogue, how we treat each other, is appropriate, is respectful. Because when emotions are already high and you forget about what it is to be civil to those around you, that's when inappropriate language can certainly pop in. And then there are some people just who come from a background where apparently they think certain discussions are okay, or were never told it wasn't okay. And that those situations we have to take head on and correct.
J.D. Mesnard is Speaker of the Arizona House. Speaker Mesnard, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
In science news, humans have long fixated on which mental traits distinguish us from other animals. Now, University of Arizona researchers are asking what our canine companions can tell us about ourselves. From the Arizona Science Desk, Nicholas Gerbis reports.
And now, Veterinarians Hospital, the continuing story of a former orthopedic surgeon who's gone to the dogs.
Dogs can't perform surgery like Dr. Bob on The Muppet Show, but research has revealed several other cognitive gifts. Just don't call them intelligent, says Evan McLean, director of the Arizona Canine Cognition Center.
We don't think about intelligence as being something that we can put a single number on and quantify.
Cognition is how animals adapt. It's a mental toolkit honed to deal with specific problems.
Which animal is smarter, a dolphin or a chimpanzee? It's very much like asking somebody, well, what's a better tool, a hammer or a screwdriver?
Even the most literally bird-brained seem surprisingly skilled in certain areas. Some birds can plan, make tools, and solve intricate puzzles. Primates and killer whales pass down cultural traits.
The dog's claim to fame from a cognitive perspective really has to do with their understanding of the social world, and particularly the way that they communicate with and understand humans.
To get a sense of this connection, consider all the meaning contained in the humble gesture of pointing.
I want to share attention about this thing with you, so I'm going to change my behavior in some way that I know you are going to interpret as me wanting you to attend to the same thing that I'm attending to so that we can experience this together.
Puppies innately grasp pointing. Other animals, even our closest kin, bonobos and chimps, not so much. So pointing, along with memory and other problem solving, plays a central role in canine testing. Grad student Gitanjali Nanadesikin and PhD student Daniel Horschler work with Remy, a 10-year-old Akita mix.
Try one. Remy, look. Remy.
The first one is on working memory. So we're trying to see how long a dog can remember things and remember where things are hidden.
Horschler openly places a treat under one of four blue cups. After a set time, from 20 seconds to a few minutes, Nanadesikin releases Remy to choose one.
If they touch the right cup, then they get rewarded for it, and we know that they remembered where we hid the food the first time.
In the next stage, Horschler hides the treat in secret, then points to the cup that conceals it.
We're trying to see if the dog can use that cue to find the food in the absence of its own knowledge.
On-campus trials rely on volunteers. Elsewhere, postdoc Emily Bray studies service and assistance dogs to find factors that affect whether they pass training or wash out. One surprising reason? Helicopter moms.
Puppies who were experiencing overly attentive mothering over the first few weeks of life actually went on to display worse independent problem-solving skills, more anxious behaviors.
And we're more likely to get bounced from the program. These findings come from more than playing with puppies. They take careful measurements, tedious number crunching, and, as Nanadesikin reminds us, some bleary eyes.
We video all of our experiments, and to turn that into usable data, live humans need to spend many hours looking at those videos.
Much of that work falls to lab coordinator Averill Cantwell. To her, it's all part of understanding the many minds with which we share the planet.
Trying to explore how these other minds might be processing the world and what's similar and what's different, and what that can then tell you about humans and human cognitive evolution is something that's just really fascinating to me.
If internal medicine had adaptive value for dogs, maybe we'd see more canine surgeons. But they probably found it easier simply to domesticate us. Nicholas Gerbis, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ, and this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the KJZZ Fronteras Desk, the city of Phoenix will hold the grand opening of an apartment complex for victims of human trafficking this week. KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports that residents will have on-site access to social workers.
The city-owned complex has 15 apartments to house survivors of human trafficking and their children. Tamara Spendley is with the city manager's office. She says Phoenix Starfish Place will run on a therapeutic sanctuary model that even landscapers will be trained on.
And we want to build like a community within there so that all the women can talk to each other and really support each other along the way.
Social workers will have offices at the complex so residents have direct access to supportive services, Spendley says.
And they're going to do staggered hours. So they'll have some on weekends to make sure they're there on weekends, some mornings and some evenings.
Spendley says the complex is geared toward victims of sex trafficking. To protect them from past abusers, the city will not publicly reveal where the complex is located. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And from the Mexico City Bureau, KJZZ's Mark Brody spoke with Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
In Mexico City, authorities are looking into possible criminal charges in cases related to buildings collapsed in September's deadly earthquake. Most recently, the parents of students killed on a college campus are asking prosecutors to investigate school administrators. Jorge Valencia from KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau is with me to talk more about this. Hey, Jorge.
Morning, Mark.
So can you walk us through what's going on in this new case this week on the campus of Monterey Tech?
Yeah, just let me back into it just a tiny little bit. Okay, so five students were killed on the campus of Monterey Tech, this prestigious university here in Mexico City. And they died when some walkway bridges collapsed on the campus. Now, the parents of two of the kids, they got an attorney and they filed a complaint before the local prosecutor's office. And they're asking prosecutors to look into what happened, because their argument is that school administrators were negligent. There was an earthquake 12 days before the one on September 19th. And they say that during that earthquake, those walkway bridges were compromised and that school officials just did not respond appropriately. And that's the reason why students were walking under those bridges, on those bridges, and five students wound up dying on September 19th.
Now, Jorge, we should mention to our listeners that you have somewhat of an insider's view of what happened here. This is a place that you're very familiar with, right?
So KJZZ has an academic partnership with Monterey Tech. And this particular campus is where we had our Mexico City campus. Our listeners, we should be very clear to our listeners that we have this connection with this story. Now, what I can tell you is that these bridges were in a very prominent location because they connected the building where the school cafeteria was. I can tell you actually that our office was in one of the buildings that was connected by this bridge. But that's about it. I can't give you any more insider information because the school has been very, what's the best way to put it? They've exercised a lot of restraint on the amount of information that they put out.
Well, if school administrators aren't saying a lot, what are they saying about this?
So I haven't been able to get in touch with them directly myself, even though I've tried through various means. They did put out a statement after this complaint was filed this week. And more or less what they're saying is that they hired their own independent investigators after the earthquake. They say that they want to know what happened more than anybody else does. And that what their investigators have found was that there were shortcomings that were there since the structures were built. They say that they're cooperating with authorities. They say that they're giving their information to authorities. And they've even gone as far to tell one news outlet that they will leave it up to the authorities to decide whether they pursue criminal charges, and if so, who they believe would be responsible.
Well, Jorge, are you seeing cases like this elsewhere in the city stemming from that September earthquake?
Yes, we have. So perhaps some of our listeners might remember the case of a little girl named Frida Sofia. It was believed that this was a miracle survival, a little girl who had survived under the rubble of an elementary school that collapsed. And it turned out to be that this was pure conjecture, that this little girl never even existed. Now, that school, there were many children who died in that school. So certainly authorities have said that they're investigating the principal, who's also the owner of that school. And just like that, there are more than 100 cases that local authorities here say that they are investigating for possible criminal charges. More concretely, There is one person who is in jail right now. There are two people who are out on the lam in cases in which authorities believe there may have been negligence or perhaps even building code wasn't followed. There was an earthquake 32 years ago in 1985. It was devastating. Many thousands of people died. And so officials set up new rules that were much more strict in order to prevent these kind of tragic catastrophes from happening. So local authorities are saying that they're looking into whether people ignore those. So it's possible that this case with Monterrey Tech, Tecnológico de Monterrey, it's possible that this won't be the last one that we'll see.
And that was Jorge Valencia from KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau.
And this is KJZZ Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Finally, in business news, the Navajo Nation Tribal Council rejected a project that called for building a tram to take paying visitors to the bottom of the Grand Canyon. In Flagstaff, KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports.
Navajo lawmakers have been reticent to develop the eastern edge of the Grand Canyon. Navajo, Hopi, and Zuni tribes believe the place where the Colorado and Little Colorado rivers meet to be sacred. The agreement with the developer would have required the tribe to pitch in $65 million for infrastructure and would not allow neighboring businesses to compete. Council Delegate Benjamin Bennett said it would bring in much-needed revenue at a time when the coal-fired power plant's future is uncertain. But Delegate Seth Damon said he felt the proposal, quote, ripped off the Navajo people. The council voted 16-2 to kill the agreement. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.